The first case on our calendar today is A23-0642 in the matter of the Wetland Conservation Act appeal filed by David Stock of a restoration order. Each party will have 15 minutes for your primary argument, and then relators will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. The podium is adjustable, so feel free to adjust it if you need to, and there is a clock on the podium that shows your time. So with that, we can get started. Council, if you could please introduce yourself and the party you represent at the beginning of your argument, we would greatly appreciate it.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. My name is Attorney Gary Lustico, and I represent the relators David Stock and David Stock Farms, LLP. Very honored to be here to answer any questions that you have. This is a matter that is of deep importance, I'm sure, to the agency and also to my client, who is a farmer in West Central Minnesota. I'd like to start, so the parties have briefed the issues. I think there's one matter I'd like to clarify or draw out more than what the briefs are. Otherwise, the briefs set those out, and I will not try to regurgitate that, but I'll obviously happily answer any questions you have. This is a matter, it's a state agency where I think it's fair to say is heavy on its rules. There's numerous statutes that oversee it. The agency enforces those statutes and rules and requires individuals, including farmers in Minnesota, to follow those rules. And we're just asking the court to require the agency to do exactly the same, which is to follow the rules. In this case, David Stock Farms, and I'll refer to them as David Stock, received a restoration order. He timely appealed that. He followed the rules. And then he also submitted two applications, one for a no loss and one for an exemption. He followed the rules in doing that and submitted those. After that, and I know it's not because this isn't a lower court matter where there was a record drawn out, this is an area I heavily practice in. The LGU assigns this to a technical evaluation panel. Evaluation panel would typically call up, not typically, just about always would call up, want to meet with the applicant for the two applications. That did not occur in this case. So the LGU never contacted the landowner, never invited them to or asked if they wanted a site visit, any of those type of things. There was no meeting, no site visit. And
Mr. Lustico, you're not claiming that is a violation of any rule or statute, are you?
I'm not saying it here, no. What I'm trying to set up that this is what the state is arguing is there's a statute and a rule, and the statute is dominant over the rule, and that there's case law, Hans Hagen and Johnson, on the issue of the 1599 as far as notice. And I'm just saying the landowner had no notice that this was going on. And then at that time...
Well, going back to the service question, I think we're familiar with the record, but I just want to clarify a couple things. There is in the record, it reflects that the decision on the two orders on the no loss were emailed to council and to relators. So there's no dispute that was those documents were emailed. Is that correct?
I'm not aware of any dispute that there was an email, and the emails make to anyone other than the landowner, I think, irrelevant, but correct. It was an email to the landowner.
And there's no argument here that the landowner didn't receive the email. I didn't see that in your brief.
It is not in the brief. Okay. That is correct.
And I also didn't see any request in the record by the landowner that the decision be mailed to the landowner.
That is correct.
Okay. And I'm asking those questions, as I'm sure you're aware, because the statute provides that 103G.2374 provides that for purposes of sections 103G.2212 to 103G.2372, which relate to wetlands, notices and other documents may be sent by electronic transmission unless the recipient has provided a mailing address and specified that mailing is preferred. So there, it doesn't appear to me that there's any indication in the record that the landowners requested mailing of the decision.
That is
correct. The question here is whether the statute or the rule applies.
I think so, yes. I mean, the practice is that they've have sent Mr. Stock numerous letters on numerous related matters, never before relied on email, not in the record. What is in the record is that the decision by Bowser denying the appeal to Bowser, so there was an appeal to Bowser, asked for it to be held in abeyance while there were the two applications to the LGU. LGU made its decision, sent that up to Bowser. Bowser then denied the appeal based on that the two permit applications were not appealed.
And there isn't any allegation in the record that that relators were going to appeal the no-loss decision.
Correct, because it was after the timeline to appeal it when they then received the notice from Bowser. So Bowser denied the...
But they could have appealed after receiving the email.
They could have appealed after receiving, at any time before the timeline ran on the appeal, correct? The only notice they had was the email, correct? And so the Bowser denial of the appeal, the original appeal of the restoration order, goes over Rule 8420 in different parts of 8420. It heavily relies on 8420. And the appeal requirement, or the notice requirement, I should say, in 8420.0255. So Bowser is arguing that the statute is prominent over the rule, that they're inconsistent, they can't be read consistently. And if you read the rule, it simply says, if you go on the reviser of statutes in Minnesota today, and a landowner in Minnesota looks this up and finds out what they're supposed to do and how they're supposed to do it, today, never, this rule has never been altered by Bowser since the statute in question was passed and became effective in 2011, so well over a decade. And the rule says the local government unit's decision must be mailed to the landowner within 10 business days of the decision. And then importantly, it also says in that same subpart 5, the notice of decision must include information on the process and time period to appeal the decision of the local government unit. The statute 103G.2374 doesn't just cover 8420, it covers WACA generally, all of the statutes. And it from 103G.2212 to 103G.2372, umbrella over all of those. And it says notices and other documents may be sent by electronic transmission. The legislature didn't say shall be sent, but Bowser, I think it's very disingenuous and unfair to have this rule for over a decade requiring the agency to do things, which this thing is, to mail the decision. And now, after the fact, say, well, there's a statute that's inconsistent. But if you read the two in the canons of construction, we cited that in our reply brief, the canons of construction say if there's a general requirement and a specific requirement, and if they can be ruled on in harmony, that they should be done so. That should be the requirement. And in this case, a may send by email. Doesn't see they have to send it by email. Says they may send it by email.
Can I ask about that, Council? I'm not sure I understand in this context why the legislature would have to say must, because just the in the context of a statute, it's referring to the notices and all this, all these sections that you're referring to may be sent by email. So if it's sent by email, it complied with the statute, and wouldn't that simply be correct? And moreover, we know that statutes take precedent over administrative rules to the extent they aren't consistent with each other, and I don't know how they could be considered not in conflict with each other, because you may send it by email and the rule says you must send it by mail. That means they're differing.
Well, they are different, obviously. One is by email, one is by letter. What Bowser has done, for the reason Bowser is, they pass a rule, they're the agency, they have required in this situation, having to do with this administrative rule.
But you would agree that the rule predates the statute.
I do agree with that, yes.
And our case law says that if a rule is in conflict with the statute prevails.
Correct. So it's a matter of if it's in conflict. And if you're the court, I'm not the court. The way I view this, and I think the correct way to view this, is if I'm the agency and I may send it by email, I can still require myself in certain circumstances, notwithstanding I may send it by email, I've decided I must send this. So LGUs, you must send this by letter, because you don't get 300 letters a day. They don't go to spam. You get a letter. Email is, for filing with courts, even discovery in civil cases, it has to be agreed upon by the parties. It's not the same process. I understand the statute says what the statute says, but the rule also says, and they are not inconsistent, an agency can comply with both. If it chooses to, it may send an email, and if it requires itself to send mail,
so assuming we agree with that argument, how is your client prejudiced by receipt by email rather than mail? I guess I'm not seeing the prejudice here, where there's no dispute that your client received the email. The email included the notices. The notice outlines the appeal process. It specifically includes appeal of LGU decisions. If you wish to appeal this decision, you must provide a written request within 30 calendar days of the date you receive the notice. There's no dispute that your client received the notice, so where is the prejudice here by email versus mail?
The prejudice is, if there's a rule that you can rely on, the past practice has always been a letter.
But how? I still don't see how your client was prejudiced by getting it by email versus mail.
The prejudice would be the assurance that mail was received, the email, it was sent, it went to that address, whether it was viewed or not. This is a large farming operation. There are numerous different people involved.
But there isn't an allegation here that they didn't see it until after see the email until after the 30-day appeal period.
It's not in the record, correct.
So I don't. Okay, thank you.
No, I understand the question. I appreciate that. There's a rule, never been questioned before. They send notices out. In this case, they didn't, and they rely on the email or the statute that says mail is allowed. And I'm not the judge. I appreciate that. I don't think that those are inconsistent. An agency can follow both. It can email, but as to this rule, it's required to mail.
Would this be a different case if the email had not been received?
I don't think it'd be, the legal part would not be different. It'd be that they required. Of course, if there wasn't, this is under Section 1599, Hans Hagen and Johnson. In both of those cases, there was someone in the audience. They knew it had been denied, and therefore they were on knowledge, and if there's appeals, they have to take the appeals within the time, because they knew it, they saw it. I brought up initially that never occurred in this case, that the technical evaluation panel didn't ask, didn't talk to them, didn't have a hearing, didn't have a meeting, so they never knew what their decision was. And in those cases, when there was actual notice, then the court went through and found the mandatory and discretionary, But in neither of those cases was there an underlying requirement, either in city, if there was, it's not in the opinion, that the city or the county ordinance required that the notice and decision be sent in writing. And I understand the state did set out in their brief the legislative history and what the purpose was. It was a convenience matter and modernization of it. These are farmers farming, and they know letters when they come in. Emails are different. The rule acknowledges that as to these matters, and this is a big issue for these landowners on whether the TEP denies or grants their application for no loss or exemption, and they rely on the mail to come, and the rule says you send it by mail. They've had over a decade. I understand the state's arguing.
I understand your argument, but maybe when you come back for rebuttal, we can discuss 15.99, because I don't see any tie in that statute to the mailing of the decision. It just talks about approval or denial of a written request, and it appears to me that the agency did deny the request within 60 days. So we can revisit that question.
I understand. Thank you.
Come back for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. May it please the court. Basically, I'm going to focus on three things here.
Can you introduce yourself for the record before you proceed?
Thank you. I apologize, Your Honor. Brian Carter with the Attorney General here representing the Board of Water and Soil Resources, who we affectionately call Bowser, of course. May it please the court. I'm going to focus on three particular issues here in my argument. One, was there legal notice? Two, was there actual notice and what effect that might have if legal notice is not found? And then two, the application of 1599, which doesn't apply to this case because the agency did, in fact, make a decision. So let me circle back to the legal notice part. And this, as I understand counsel's argument and his briefing, comes down to whether the statute conflicts with the rule. And it does, and therefore the statute trumps. If I may, I'm going to take a brief pause here because my initial point I wanted to make, I'm going to circle back to the facts and then get back to legal notice. So I apologize for the disjointed presentation, but I don't want to let this point go without a rejoinder. Unless I misunderstood counsel in his argument this morning, he stated that there was no site visit before the LGU issued its restoration orders. And that Mr. Stock or any employee of the relators were not aware of what was going on. That is, in fact, not correct. In fact, if the court looks at the record, and I would point it to the record citation 5, page number 5, so that's Bowser 5, you can see the LGU's description of how Mr. Stock himself was on site during the site visit and made numerous statements to the individuals on the site during the investigation. And that's also described in the facts section of our brief with appropriate citations. I would also point out that it wasn't just relators that got the email from the LGU about the denial of the applications for an exemption and no loss. In fact, counsel for relators was also on that email as well. So the actual notice bit goes beyond just, you know, an unsophisticated farmer getting an email rather than a mail. No, in fact, it's a sophisticated regulated entity, and sophisticated, regulated party with counsel who was actively representing them in the matter. And that was all when the LGU denied the applications before Bowser even got involved. Okay, so now I'll circle back to the legal sufficiency point, the legal sufficiency of service, which comes down to, I think pretty clearly, does the statute conflict with the rule? It absolutely does, for the reasons we state in the brief. And I'm just going to crystallize one point of the conflict, because even at its simple level, the rule says you are not required, I'm sorry, the statute says you are not required to mail. So adding a requirement that you have to mail just ipso facto conflicts, and that's the end of it. But here, there's even more nuance to it, because we have two government agencies, right? We have Bowser, who is the rulemaking entity, and then we have the LGU, who under both the statute and the rule is one of the primary enforcement agencies. And the statute was directed at the LGUs in addition to Bowser and giving them the ability to use electronic transmission. And so what we have is...
Help us understand if your interpretation is correct, why Bowser or why the rule hasn't been amended since 2011 when the statute was enacted.
I don't know the answer to that. I do know that when Bowser went to the legislature and talked about the amendments that included 103G, 7324, they talked explicitly about, hey, we're trying to increase the efficiency of this. So Bowser clearly thought, and so that legislative record, the quotes there are Bowser actually talking to the legislature. So Bowser clearly thought that the statute was going to preempt this requirement for the rule. Now, ideally, absolutely, the rule should be cleaned up and obsolete portions of the rule should be taken out, but that is not a prerequisite to a statute overriding a rule. And here, that's exactly what we have. We have the legislature saying, okay, LGUs, you don't have to mail those notices of your orders any longer. You can send them by email. And that's exactly what the LGU here did. And now we have a ex ante rule that says, no, LGUs, you can't mail them. So there's a clear conflict, and the statute trumps.
Well, so relators argue, though, that it's not really a conflict because it's Bowser deciding that something more specific should happen, and it has the ability to do that.
So a couple...
In other words, the statute is permissive, and this is just the agents, Bowser, deciding how the LGUs must provide the notice.
And I think that right there is the point. The legislature has said, LGUs, you don't have to mail. And so Bowser then can't come in and override the legislature's statute on that. It's not as if Bowser was saying to itself, okay, I'm going to mail these. No, it's Bowser telling a different government. I mean, this is Ottertail County, right? It is a different government agency. And the legislature has given that government agency the ability to send these by electronic transmission.
And these rules, or the rule at issue, was adopted by Bowser originally.
Yes, Bowser is the entity that promulgates all of these rules.
Okay.
And that's you know, why Bowser was at the legislature, you know, asking for the statutes.
Can you just clarify that? If they're the rulemaking agency and that's their rule, they really didn't need to go to the legislature. They could have changed, gone through the administrative rule changing process.
They could have done that as well, but it was the statute enacted a whole comprehensive set of changes to the statute that had implications for pre-existing rules. So I would imagine it was in the interest of efficiency, of government efficiency, that they sort of packaged all of these things together, which were a mix of, you know, things that had to be enacted by statute and things that Bowser perhaps could have changed by rule. But even if there wasn't the interplay, and I don't think this is present in this case because we do have two government entities, but I would also say even if it was one government entity, if the legislature says you are not required to do X, an agency cannot then require itself to do X, right? That is a conflict. The legislature in that particular instance would have made a calculus, presumably, that in the interest of good, efficient...
I'm not sure I follow that. If the legislature gives the agency the discretion to do it a certain way and the agency decides to do it a different way, in other words, if the legislature had said you must send the notice by electronic transmission, then a rule that says you must mail it, that would be a clear conflict. But where the legislature says you may do something and then the agency decides itself to that it wants to do it a different way, I'm not clear how that's a conflict. I understand your argument about the Bowser requiring an LGU, which is a different governmental entity, that is why that conflicts with the statute. But I guess I'm not clear how an agency deciding to require mailing when given the, you know, that may is not mandatory. Yeah, why there's a conflict there.
Yeah, thank you, Your Honor. I think it's a good question, and I think the answer is a bit nuanced. I think there's a difference between the agency having a permissive right to do something from the legislature and then choosing from time to time to do something greater than that. That's not in conflict. But to establish a rule through rulemaking that binds not only a particular action in a particular case, but all actions in the future with new administrations, right? With new.
So you're saying one administration can't bind another through rulemaking?
In this case, where you have the statute that gives the permissive ability to use electronic transmission, I would argue that to take away that permissive right is in conflict with that statute. But I do think that issue is actually not before the court right now because we do have two regulating entities. And with that,
I'll ask you about the standard of review. Your brief did not address the standard of review, or Bowser's brief didn't. I want to just confirm that you agree that 14.69 is the applicable standard that we apply in this case.
That's correct, Your Honor, and that's hardwired into Bowser's actions through the enabling statutes for Bowser and the LGUs. Yes, it's 14.69. Okay.
So given that, is there any prejudice in this case, even assuming we were to agree with Relator's view on this conflict question, you know, even if they were to show a conflict, I think under 14.69 to reverse, we would still need to find some sort of that their substantial rights were affected, that there's some sort of prejudice.
That's right, Your Honor, and that leads into my second point, which is actual notice. There was actual notice not only to relators, but also to relators' counsel, therefore no prejudice, no effect of substantial rights. The decision should be affirmed. And at the end of the day, it is that simple. If getting beyond the conflict question. And so with that, I'll move to the 15.99. A couple points on 15.99. It just does not apply here. There is no question that the LGU made a decision and emailed that decision. It was in writing, and the reasons for it were elaborated on in that writing. So all of 15.99's requirements were met. Moreover, the automatic grant of the request or the application under 15.99 is an extraordinary remedy, and it only applies when the agency has not made a decision. That happened here. And basically, Relator's argument is taking requirements and rules and trying to backfeed them into 15.99 and create a situation where the little technical violations of rules result in this extraordinary major of an automatic grant, and that's just not the way 15.99 works, nor it should. I should also say, too, that it is not entirely, and I'll just point this out, it is not in the brief, but it is not entirely clear to me, based on state precedent, that a 15.99 action like this could even be asserted under writ of certiorari rather than a request for a writ of mandamus in the district court. I don't think it's particularly important to this case, but I did want to highlight it to the for the court. In the 500 LLC versus Minneapolis case I have the site here, 837 Northwest 2D 257. And with that, my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal for the relators.
Thank you. I wanted to address, Your Honor, the question you have as far as how can it not be in conflict. And I think the reason it's not was expressed in the argument just now from the attorney for Bowser, Mr. Parker. It's that it gives the permissive ability. It doesn't say that you must send electronic. So in this case, I think if the statute had said you must send electronic, then that would be, and the question, I think the agency could decide to also send by mail, but it would have to send. And it's a common sense thing. If I said you can do anything you want on these 7 days, but as to this one thing, you have to do it on that day. As to that thing, so under this rule, they have to send a written notice.
Would you agree that under the rule is telling the local governments what it must do? A local government what it must do when it sends the decision?
Well, it's telling the local government what it must do. Bowser is telling itself that it must require that in order to have assured that that has been done.
But
that,
here it's the local government that's sending the decision, not Bowser.
That is correct. It was a local government unit, which is all overseen, and the appeal was based on that requirement of the local government to send it out. That's what the basis of the Bowser's appeal was. So it's part and parcel of what Bowser is doing. To clear up one matter, so it doesn't sound like I'm saying something that was disingenuous with the record on the site visit, I wasn't trying to indicate the agency had never been out at the site. What I'm saying is once the applications had been submitted to the LGU, the LGU never further contacted. I'd say they always do. But in this case, they did not. They did not contact Mr. Stock and say, can we have a site visit, show us your side of this, that type of thing. There's some allegations of what Mr. Stock said out in the field, but there wasn't anything once the application, which the application on its face contradicts what the agency individuals had said Mr. Stock said in the field. On 1599, my point there, excuse me, that we set out in our brief is that Johnson and Hans Hagen, they set out, and the facts of those cases are, The applicant was in the hearing. They were there. They heard what happened. They knew that it had happened. And then also there was no indication that there was some other written requirement that that decision be sent to them. I understand the court in Johnson did address that any agency is at risk if it doesn't have a written finding that could be determined as arbitrary and capricious. But the point is there was not in those cases, which is distinguishable from this case. And as the attorney for Bowser indicated, the rules should be cleaned up. I mean, there's a rule saying that a person relies on, they're prejudiced when they rely on it, subject to this court's determination otherwise. And Bowser said, yeah, I know we said that, but you can't rely on that. And that is the prejudice to Mr. Stock in this case and to anyone that is presented with this fact. And they should have cleaned it up if they wanted to. I do not see how the rule is inconsistent with the statute. The statute says you may send it. It doesn't say you must send it. Obviously, they can still send things by writing. It wouldn't be, I do not think Bowser would be here arguing, well, we sent it by writing. It doesn't count and would dismiss the, or grant the appeal then. They are not inconsistent. And they have the permissive ability to do both. And as to these matters, it decided that the appeal has to be noticed in writing. Any other questions? I mean, I see it as real straightforward, and Mr. Sock thought it was real straightforward, that there was a rule, he relied on it, and here we are a year later.
Okay, seeing no further questions, we thank you both for your arguments here today. The arguments were very helpful. We will consider the matter and issue our decision within the statutory time frame.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Have a good day.